Prescott. Welcome to the debut of Prescott Talks, brought to you by Prescott E-News. And today we have Chris Cugno, is the co-pilot today, and our guest is Phil Good, current councilman. And I'd like to remind everybody, Chris Cugno was a councilman, a former councilman here in Prescott. So
yeah, that was a good one.
Yeah, that was during the great times, right?
And you're claiming that I'm not?
No, I'm just
I have official government documents to prove I'm good.
Built my fortune.
We're going to have a really interesting show today. I can see it already.
I can see it already.
But thank you so much, Phil, for coming in and speaking to us. And we have, you know, just some conversation we want to talk about, the going-ons, what's happening in Prescott. Also, I'd like to remind everybody that we are joined by Ms. Lynn, and she's taking your questions. If you have a question, go ahead and type it in, and we'll be sure to ask the councilman what might be on your mind. So, Phil.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much.
I was excited to be on the same show at the same time with both you, Glenn, and you, Chris. Both of us have... all of us, as a matter of fact, have kind of a history at different organizations here in Yavapai County and Prescott in particular. So I know we're going to have a good time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I want to kind of start off, Phil, with what, you know, on some of your past experiences. I mean, you are the current council person for Prescott right now. You held a position in the hospital board.
I did, Central Yavapai Hospital District.
Yeah, I think you were planning and zoning too, right?
I was on planning and zoning for 2 years. So hospital district board also for 2 years. I intended originally to stay on that board even after I was elected. But as you know, I did some kind of research and wrote a couple articles on special districts under Arizona revised statutes. And there are something like 44 different special districts throughout Yavapai County. But the only one that requires you to resign your position if you're elected to another position, even if it's unpaid, is the hospital district board. So I didn't know that uniqueness to it, and I thought I'd be able to stay on that board, but unfortunately I had to resign from it. So pretty proud in a couple of years. We are able to, a lot of people don't realize that what this board is. There hasn't been a contested election for a board director in over 15 years, I believe. But the Central Yavapai Hospital District actually owns all the land and the buildings that YRMC West here in Prescott operates. So they're kind of the landlord, and YRMC, John Amos and his team operate the hospital under the ownership of the taxpayers. So one of the first things I discovered was the fact that all of our taxpayers who own these buildings, I looked into some of the basic business coverage you would need if you're operating a business. And I discovered that the liability insurance, if there was a catastrophic loss, YRMC operations would be the sole beneficiary of the proceeds of that. So I was able to get the district covered under their liability policy. So if there was a loss, the taxpayers wouldn't be left holding the bag. So that was, I thought that was pretty substantial.
That's pretty monumental, absolutely. Right.
And that's one nice thing that you do, Phil, I think, is you look out for the taxpayer. I think a lot of times people get on these boards and they feel like they become part of that organization and they're working for that organization, where you got to keep it dialed in where you are representing the citizens.
Well, I find that to be true in almost every government organization. After a certain amount of time, you think that you work for that organization rather than the constituents that voted you in. And I feel a direct responsibility for those people to make sure that the tax dollars that come out of their pocket every paycheck or at the end of every year when you file your taxes are truly looked at and protected, and making sure that those tax dollars pay only for the things that they are going to benefit from in a broad sense, and provide the essential services they expect from especially local governments.
you know, a bad example of being different than the private sector, I think, was showcased with this, the across the board 2.5%, I think it was, increase in raises that the federal government was going to hand out, where in the private sector, you give raises based on merit,
not just on time spent.
And I think when I saw that come out, I was like, you know, why would you even try and do better? Everyone's going to get the same thing.
Right. There's no incentive.
Worker, right.
Right.
Yeah. Great comments. And then moving on, you were vice chair of our Sober Home Committee here in Prescott.
Yeah, Glenn and I. So, I was proud to serve on that committee.
That's how Phil and I got to know each other.
Right.
So that was.
So we were able to enact the permissive state law that our representative Noel Campbell was able to get enacted and get those regulations in place over the course of almost 2 years sitting on that committee. And even though we also benefited from some of the insurance investigation that was going on, I mean, the bottom line was we had north of 170 sober homes here in the city, and by the time we concluded our tenure on that board, it was down to right around 30.
Right, so it was a
substantial reduction, and we've been able to keep it in that area.
Well, it was not only in 30s, but it also had standards, and I think that was really our goal. You know, we were never trying to shut down sober homes, but we were trying to put a standard in the home for both the community and the people that were in it. And
I think
a lot of that was misunderstood by, you know, many people. But
Our focus was on safety, making sure the people that were in those treatment programs had a safe environment. It was properly supervised.
Yes.
And I think we have a pretty good group of homes now that do provide quality treatment.
Well, we've always had group homes in Prescott. I mean, we've had them for a long, long time. But I think all of a sudden you got this thing where people that didn't know what they were doing started running these homes because it was so profitable.
Cash cows.
Yeah,
I mean,
cash
huge.
Cows. And I think the thing that really helped out a lot was the insurance companies finally said, we have enough and cut it down. Now, and did you find that, because this all started when I was on council, right before you got on there, and I found that the people that were responsible were coming to us saying, yeah, you guys need to get a control of this because here's what's happening out there. Did you still see that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There have always been a percentage of legitimate programs and homes that provide housing for people that are in those treatment programs, and really the bad operators were damaging the entire reputation of the industry. So the legitimate operators were really helpful in supporting us to apply those standards to the ones that were taking advantage of the insurance benefits available primarily under the Affordable Care Act that classified all the people who are involved in substance abuse as protected class of citizens, and that allowed them to be able to live in normal neighborhoods where a lot of people expected that they would be in some type of a facility. And that protection allowed a lot of these homes to open up everywhere, even multiple homes on the same street.
And they started to cluster, There was I remember a girl that came in, she had four little kids, and she had 15 rehab homes within two blocks of her house. Her husband was a contractor, his tools were getting stolen out of the truck because they were easy to pawn and sell out. You know, it was bad news. So it's good to see, and it break my heart. I'd come in the Iron Springs Road, and you'd see the girl crying with the two garbage bags full of clothes, and you can tell she just got kicked out of some house. And they were just dumping them on the streets of Prescott.
I actually was involved. I had two people. Somebody called me and said, hey, I had two people who were just thrown out right on the corner of the square for some rinky-dink violation in the home. So I went down. I met with these two people. It was like a 23 and a 24-year-old kids from New York. And they didn't have they had no money. They had nothing. They just dropped them off with their bags, and they said, fend for yourself. So I took them over. We actually went over to the cafe and had breakfast. We were able to contact relatives because these kids didn't really want to contact the relatives. They're like, hey, man, we just got kicked out of a sober home right away. You know,
right.
There's Trump's wall, if you will. You know, there's a wall with the family. So, but as it turned out, we were able to get them down to Phoenix, get them into Sky Harbor and fly them back home. Talked to them several times. And matter of fact, during the ad hoc committee, we had one of them call in and give their testimony on what occurred in the sober home. As it turned out, their insurance ran out.
Right.
And
that was a very common denominator.
Yeah. Their insurance ran out. Somehow or another, they were violating a rule, and they're out on the square. So I talked to those kids for quite a while and then lost contact with them, hoping all the best. But, you know, these young guys that are on opiates, there's just not really a great percentage that make it through that experience. Correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, if I recall it's like 11% below 25 actually stay off the opiates, and most of them have a fatal experience.
And I think you're high on that number. I thought I heard it was more around 6%.
Yeah. Well, I think
that's coming out of the homes. Yeah. I'm talking about overall life experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's about 11% that they actually make it out of that opiate addictive lifestyle. Completely.
Yeah, it's a small percentage, and most of the treatment programs are based on a 12-step program, which they consider "quote unquote" the gold standard.
Yeah.
But it's just it's been around for many, many years. AA is based on 12 steps, and that's been around since about the 1920s.
Yeah.
But they've never really had the ability to clinically analyze the effectiveness of alternate treatment programs.
Mm-hmm.
So because this one has been around so long,
mm-hmm.
Insurance companies consider it legitimate,
even
though the percentage of recovery is very, very small.
Well, that's like, you know, we in the committee, we would hear people get up and go, well, our place has like a 60%, you know, success rate. And right away, I go, oh, okay, you know, that's not the national average. That's not even close to
right. How do you measure that?
And how do you measure? And how they measured it is they would call like, hey, are you still taking opiates? Well, no, I'm good, man. Everything's life's good. Okay, you're a success.
Success.
Yeah, success. So, you know, the numbers were way skewed. You know, we got to follow along with the reality of the addiction. So,
and you know, Glenn, there was people that were 3 months sober, mm-hmm. starting their own rehab home.
Yeah,
right.
And you know,
right.
Then you got the fox watching the chickens.
Right.
You know, bad things happen.
And that's where our neighborhood started to, you know, our neighborhood started complaining, and rightfully so. But, you know, it's kind of, again, the success of our ordinance that we put in Prescott is, you know, it was never, to the best of my knowledge, Phil, and maybe you can comment on it, never challenged.
No, it never was.
Because
in fact, even the original space ordinance that we put in that designated a certain
feet.
Distance in many communities has been challenged by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services as being discriminatory.
Right.
And we actually had a team come in from HHS and visit us because they felt that this might have been discriminatory as well.
Right.
But they stated that they had never seen the extent of clustering in any community
as it was
Prescott.
Here.
Now, did you go through that?
That was prior.
That was me. That was you. Let me tell you an experience about that. You know, I'm sitting in there and I'm telling these guys the stuff that's going on because they just got the complaint, so they got to go out. And these are these federal people that come and check you out. HUD, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And they start talking, and I say, you know what? There's 15 homes within 2 blocks of the house. And you could see their jaws drop.
Mm-hmm.
They said, we'd never support something like that.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean,
HUD,
it was...
For those who don't know, that's the Housing and Urban Development Department of the federal government. So they look at the housing discrimination potential. Health and Human Services actually regulates the insurance benefits that are available through the government.
Well, you know, one of the things I think was a successful 2107, which was Noel's bill, is he involved not only the public, but the operators as well. Because Phil touched on it. A lot of the operators were angry about all this as well as the community by these fly-by-night houses just popping up. So some of the good operators all got together along with NOAA, along with the community, and that's how 2107 was actually passed, thanks for NOAA. And then we did the ordinance, and it was the same thing. We had the community come in, and we also had the operators come in, the good operators. And so I really think that's probably one of the reasons it was never challenged, because the operators were saying, like, and we had Doug Dolan on the on the committee, man, we need something out there. We need to control these guys out that, you know, are just letting these kids out at the coffee shops or workout, you know, going over to Planet Fitness and just dropping them off, and they're running and smoking and doing whatever they do. Without anybody there. And that was one of the reasons we had that 24-hour manager, house manager. You just can't do that. And they always have to have somebody under, you know, in control.
Providing legitimate supervision.
And giving supervision.
As a matter of fact, I just saw it. Doug Dolan recently had a post on Facebook that he's with MatForce.
He is. Yes, he is. He's going to be one of the ambassadors of MatForce. And I haven't talked to Lynn about this, but I'm going to love to talk to Dole or to MatForce and Doug and see if we can't get them in here and speak about some of their mission as well.
Yeah, because we need to...
Yeah, go ahead.
We have a question from Corey Gardner. He wants to know, he said, did we go from like 150 houses to closer down to 50, or to closer down to 30? So right. What's the current status?
We get periodic updates, and it's stayed right at around 30, 31. So it's been very steady, which I think probably is a confirmation of the fact that the remaining homes are pretty legitimate operators.
Yeah. Now, is that companies or is that homes themselves?
That's individual homes. Yeah, so some of them still have multiple homes under there.
And they're being inspected annually or biannually or...
Well, yeah, we probably ought to fast forward to where we are today.
Yeah.
This permissive ordinance was available to any city in Arizona to enact, but as we experienced, it does take effort and resources to get good regulations in place and inspections going on. And some of those communities didn't want to invest in that, so they... engage the legislature, and now we have a statewide law that it will supersede our ability to monitor, inspect, and regulate within our own city. So the State Department of Health Services, and I've been involved in helping to draft the rules that they will enact, which are going to go into effect the 1st of July this year. And the inspections and the licensing and all the things that we've done very effectively here in the city are going to be taken over by the state.
Gotcha.
So John Palladini, our state attorney, and I have been involved in all of those meetings, and I think we've been able to shape some of the rules to be as effective as possible, I think, within the structure of that law. So our concerns at this point are, will there be sufficient funding to have enough inspectors? Will those inspectors be capable enough to be able to respond? And will that response be effective enough? Because some of the rules right now screen the city from even knowing who's applying to start a home. Which is problematic because you could have two homes within that space restriction, both applying for licensing, and we don't even know about it. And they could go through this whole long licensing process and invest the money to get it done, and then find out that they're right next door to each other. And they wouldn't be allowed to operate. So there are some problems here, and we were actually meeting with some of the other concerned cities about whether we should go back to the legislature and have some of these possible problems clarified before it goes into effect. But we figured, and my comment was, no matter what law you put into effect, there's going to be unintended consequences. You just don't know what they're going to be. So do we go back to the legislature now, fix some of these potential problems, and then find out there's more and have to go back again? We kind of decided as a group that we probably have done as much as we can with the draft rules. We're going to allow them to go into effect with the hope that they're going to be done well.
Yeah.
And then when we do find the unintended consequences, we'll try to address those as a whole with the next legislation.
You guys had to start. You had to start somewhere.
Yeah, you had to start somewhere.
I mean, put something up there, let them shoot it full of holes and refine it.
Yeah, it's supposed to be self-sustaining. The licensing fees are supposed to pay for the cost of the department's inspectors and regulations and things like that. So it's not inexpensive. It's going to be probably $1,000, maybe a little bit more than $1,000 per operator per year. And then there's a charge per resident. So it has the potential to be done well. Mm-hmm. But I don't know about you guys, but I'm a little skeptical when it comes to government regulation being done well.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, you know, it's interesting how government works because, you know, just from the vision of this old guy, you know, I'm retired, number one, so I'm just kind of watching. But I know Noel tried to get some legislation the first time around, mm-hmm. and it was shot down because of the cost to the state and HHS. And so then he came back with 2107, which was a permissive bill that if you're a city that wanted to do something, you can. Right. You don't. Mm-hmm. And then and I heard a lot of the comments while I was down in Phoenix that, you know, well, this is a Prescott problem. It's not my problem in our area. Well, sorry to say that it became a problem in that area. Then all of a sudden, mm-hmm. everybody was on board with Noel saying, man, what do we do? You know, and Noel spearheaded this challenge. And it actually started in the Senate because homes were popping all over Scottsdale and Mesa. And, mm-hmm. you know, the neighborhoods were saying the same thing to their representatives as the Presconians were to our council. So that's kind of how that ball started rolling. And but like Chris said, you know, you got to start somewhere, and we're back to kind of where we really wanted to go with some kind of state legislation to put a standard in these homes. I just hope that it comes to fruition where it's, you know, as successful as I think ours has been here in our hometown.
We'll see how that that issue plays out.
Yeah. You know, I've got a question. When you're kind of related but not related, and we talk about government putting on burdens mm-hmm. on private sector, and we introduced the business license that we had to put in, right. and really it was to know what's happening in your town. That's what it was. So, because we had no idea what businesses were here, mm-hmm. we couldn't offer any kind of information for someone moving in. Mm-hmm. But then the businesses started saying, you know, they were okay with the $35 or right. whatever, but now they have fire inspections that they have to pay for, and they have something else. Where is that right now? Has that changed at all? Do you know?
There's still some concerns about that licensing cost escalating beyond what was initially expected. Fire inspections, I think, are legitimate. However, in some types of businesses, it doesn't seem to really apply. And sometimes you'll have a business suite with 6, 7, or 8, 9, mm-hmm. 10 businesses in there. And those inspections could be all done at one time. So your unit costs would be low, but every business has to pay the same fee. So,
but the word is that the businesses are already paying for the fire department. Why are they getting additional fees for this inspection?
That's a question.
Yeah.
I had a problem with it originally because it was proposed to be providing some benefit for the businesses themselves. They'd have a registration on the city website. They would be identified what type of business they had, so potentially future businesses that wanted to relocate here mm-hmm. could understand what their competitive market would be and whether this would be a good place to operate mm-hmm. and where would be the best location for them to operate. So we've done some of that. I don't think it's adequate enough because they're just kind of general in nature. You know, it's like retail and said, okay, what kind of retail? Mm-hmm. And then it took probably, close to a year to get that loaded into the website. And I felt that we've kind of breached our contract because we were saying, okay, businesses, this is the benefit you're going to get for this cost.
Okay.
And both parties have to perform. Right? Well, we weren't performing. So I was pressuring Lars, our licensing guy, to say, listen, if this doesn't get done, I'm going to propose to the council that we repeal this because we're in breach, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
So guess what? It got done.
And I think one thing that was, that this came on about the same time as the group home thing came on, and one of the reasons that was pushing this was the all of a sudden influx of Airbnb and homes for vacation rental. And with the rehab homes, they were going into our residential neighborhoods and disrupting the residential lifestyle. The Airbnb stuff was doing the same thing. And I'm a private sector guy. I like the free markets and industry, but if you had a vacation home right next to your home, you have people coming in that are on vacation, and what they were doing was they were leaving the dogs in the backyard, and every week you'd get a new set of dogs that would just be barking all night because they're freaked out. They don't know where they're at, and these guys are, you know, they're on vacation. They're partying until the wee hours of the morning, and you got to get up and work it at 6 a.m., you know? So I don't know if are we getting a handle on that? Because I think Ducey jumped in and said, it's okay.
It is, and it was passed, and it does take away the city's ability to regulate the location and the number of those homes, and our hands are pretty well tied. There is a new bill in this legislature trying to define homes that are really bad neighbors, that are having multiple complaints, causing, you know, trash or debris in the neighborhood, and extending some regulatory control to the local municipalities to be able to kind of rein those in. So what were you talking about? Consequences.
There's a fairness on bed tax. So every hotel, you're charging them a bed tax, which I think is bringing in about, what, 800 grand, something like that?
Yeah, it's a substantial amount.
But Airbnb is getting a free ride on that. They're not having to pay the taxes, which are used to exclusively promote tourism, which they're getting the benefit off of as well.
Right, and then we have the state proposition that was passed excluding any taxation for services. And this is providing a service, a lodging service, where it's not a product. So they're excluded from some of those tax implications as well.
Is there still a phone number? I know when we were on committee, Phil, we had a phone number that the citizens were able to call in and say, you know, I'm having an issue with this home or that home. Is that still, and he's going to a special black book here, so I guess
there is. Oh, just happened to have my hotline number.
I'll be darned.
Now, folks, this was not predetermined. Yeah. I carry this around in my pocket.
He does.
Along with my U.S. Constitution.
Yep. Is this an age thing, Phil? Because I'm writing more things down.
You know what's bad on my deals? I have to write down the punchline when I tell a joke. Yeah. You know, I mean, I remember the joke, I just don't remember the punchline. So,
good.
Anyway,
well,
go ahead, Phil.
If you're dealing with any type of a code violation that you suspect or even know, the city does have a code violation hotline. That number's 928-442-2633. So, debris or trash or noise or any of those kinds of things that we just discussed would be responded to by calling this number. So again, 928-442-2633. And I happen to have another one here too. If you have problems with your street, you got potholes, you've got other issues that are street related, we have a street hotline number, which is 928-777-1666. So again, 928-777-1666. And,
awesome.
You know, we can talk about public work projects too.
Well, does those numbers include like overgrown weeds? Because I know that you know what, I have never heard of a wildfire in January. And I was driving on 89A the other day. The amount, they're already having these giant grass fires. And you know, you're never going to cut all that because it's out in the middle of nowhere. But you know, even in town, if you start looking around, there's a lot of overgrown grass. And even when the dirt is wet, you have straw that's sticking up about 2-3 feet.
Well, we've made some changes in staffing throughout the departments in the city, which I'm quite frankly pretty pleased with. And one of the key areas that I have been working with the city manager on is to do a more diligent amount of code enforcement when it comes to blight and overgrown grass and things like that, because in the past, we determined infrastructure improvements totally based on condition. So if you had a bad street or something like that, it would be prioritized based on condition, and then upgrades would be planned for that. But what we ended up having is kind of a patchwork of neighborhoods that had good streets and neighborhoods that had not so good streets, and some of them be right next to each other.
Yeah.
So I proposed to the city manager that we take more of a strategic overall plan on upgrading and maintaining our neighborhoods based upon proximity to the downtown core, because everybody that lives here spends a lot of time. That's where the entertainment, the restaurants, all the activities on the plaza happen. And when tourists and visitors and potential business owners, they always come down to the plaza, and then they start kind of investigating the community from that core area. So I said, why don't we take our priority, add a proximity component to it, and then start working on upgrading the infrastructure, the streets, and the neighborhoods, along with diligent code enforcement. So as you radiate from the core, you're going to see nice, upgraded, well-maintained neighborhoods, which I think will attract investment. It'll attract infill development rather than all these communities that are on the far edges of the community where we have to extend services. We'd much rather have infill development where we already have police and fire protection, etc. So we now have two code enforcement officers where a year ago we only had one.
Right.
And we just had a meeting, the city manager and I, with them to let them know how important their job is and to recognize what they're doing. We've also had a couple of community cleanup activities over in the Dexter neighborhood and those areas where, you know, people volunteered to come in and help clean up and take that old sofa out of the front lawn and other things like that. And it's really starting to make an impact. We've seen a couple of like small 6, 8, 12 unit apartment projects now come into those areas. So I think it's starting to make an impact.
You know, Prescott Valley had a really excellent program. It was called the Roving Dumpster Program. And you could sign up in your neighborhood if you had a block watch or something like that. And we would go place 3 8-yard dumpsters out there and a roll-off box.
Yeah.
And you could dump in there for free. You come out, we pick it up, and they were working off a grant that they got. And the funny thing was, when you talk about the sofas and stuff, people would sneak stuff into the roll-off box at night. We'd leave this empty roll-off box.
And it was free.
And they could come out, they could do it for free. But we'd come there the next day, here you got the chairs, you got the mattresses, you know, all snuck in there. I thought it was really funny. But, you know,
that
it was
happened.
Really effective.
We had, I think, 6 of those big dumpsters, maybe 8 of them, over at Prescott High School when we were doing the Dexter neighborhood. And we had people drive by and they had a pickup truck, and they go, what's going on there? And
right.
I said, it's a free debris collection. You mean I could go in my backyard and bring something back? And son of a gun, they came back about an hour later with a big old sofa that they dumped in there, too.
Yeah.
So it was free, and it supports every part of the community.
And, you know, you got the free dump days, but a lot of people don't have a trailer. A lot of people don't have the pickup truck with the bed. They just got the little car. And a lot of people, especially in the Prescott community, they don't have the back to do that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times the volunteers in that community would say, oh, you need us to go do that? They'd come up and pick the chair up from the person, throw it.
And, you know, speaking of sober homes, we had a couple of those big white vans that were full of people that were living in those treatment homes and those sober homes. They came by to volunteer to help out.
Yeah,
it was wonderful.
Yeah. Well, you know, that does another subject completely. You know, we we do talk about sober homes a lot, but a lot of these homes, they, as part of the recovery program, they do have their people come out and
community service.
You know, and you know, that's kind of like what we did when we were on the committee. That was all community service.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I was thinking this while you were talking about that. You know, even the Citizens Patrol with the police department, I know they were actually having their eyes used if they were somewhere that looked like it was out of line, that they would be able to report back to the zoning and have somebody come out and take a look at debris that shouldn't be there.
Our sole code enforcement officer at the time, Mike Fleming, actually commented to us at the committee that he was so overwhelmed that all he could do was respond to a specific reported complaint,
mm-hmm.
and he would drive by a home in the same street that he couldn't stop because of the amount of backlog he was dealing with.
Yeah.
So I think that's improved dramatically since then as well.
Very good. What else? Anything else you want to talk? How are we doing, Lynn? Are we in?
Yeah, it's been a little more than 30 minutes.
Okay.
So however long you want to keep going.
Well, I think I've got a ton of questions on the new hotel going in.
Yeah. Okay.
And I know you're watching that, Bill. And, you know, it seems, is this going to be a good deal for the city, a bad deal for the city? It seems to me like the price for the land is too low, and it seems like the city is on the hook for infrastructure. Is this going to work out for the city, or are we getting taken for a ride by somebody from the outside?
No, I don't think so. I think if you look at the benefit of this particular project overall, mm-hmm. and its ability to be almost an anchor for the plans to improve the Granite Creek Corridor as a kind of a almost a recreational amenity or a tourist type of a amenity where people can come in and walk that corridor and enjoy the greenery and have the connection with the nearby restaurants and things like that. It reminds me, you know, over the course of my professional career, I counted one time, I think I moved 14 times, and I lived in four different states. I lived in Denver, had a corporate
city.
I know, Colorado. Okay. So that is Colorado, number one. Thank you, Chris. Then I had a corporate office in San Antonio, which is in Texas. That's number two. I lived in Houston. I lived in Dallas. And, of course, I lived in Phoenix back in 81. And then multiple locations in California as well. So seeing the Riverwalk in San Antonio, I was born and raised in Sacramento, California, and they had this big American River location that went through the heart of the city, and they put a big bike trail in there and mm-hmm. parks and things, and it became, you know, just a heavily used, highly valued a recreational opportunity. So I see the Granite Creek Corridor as being a smaller version of that, but mm-hmm. something that could be really, really positive. So to your point, extending utilities and infrastructure is something the city commonly does for virtually every development. Of course, once we extend it to that property, then it's the owners of the property to continue that and to provide sewer and water and electrical to their development itself. So they've got a substantial investment in trying to get that building plat significantly raised enough to deal with the fact that it's in a floodplain. So they estimate their cost for just getting the foundation set up at over $700,000.
Mm.
So it's not an insignificant amount. The Planning and Zoning Commission met yesterday and had the first look at some of the details of the development itself. Now there's two aspects to this. The contract for their lease of the land, which is city owned,
mm-hmm.
and then of course their investment and the actual building of the property. So if we look at the contract itself, there's been a lot of controversy about that because of the stated value of this. Now,
right.
This is a lease purchase,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a combination or a hybrid between a normal acquisition of city property, which has to be publicly bid mm-hmm. and go to the highest bidder, mm-hmm. or a lease, which in the city charter allows the city manager to negotiate a lease, because it doesn't have to be publicly bid because it's not acquiring city or taxpayer property. It's just a lease of that property. So a lease purchase, for those that aren't familiar with it, is a lease fee of city property for a specific period of time, and then an option to actually purchase that property sometime during the course of the lease. So that is not addressed in the city charter. Mm-hmm. There's no mention of a lease purchase. Purchase is addressed, lease is addressed, but not a lease purchase. So that's why it didn't really go out to a public bid as a lot of people expected. It was negotiated mm-hmm. with a determination of what was considered to be a fair purchase amount, which was $300,000, that could be exercised within 5 years or up to the full period of the lease, which is a 50-year lease.
Yeah, wow.
And it has a 1.5% annual escalator in there that isn't actually applied annually. It's accumulated over 5 years. So they did get a 7.5% increase after 5 years. And then the lease fee per month is designated as $1,250 or $15,000 a year. So,
but the real value, I mean, and I understand that. I want to make sure the it's probably washing pretty good with the money, but the real benefit is additional hotel rooms, which we're desperate for, cleaning up that area, and what are we going to do with the hobos?
Right.
Because that's their place down there right now.
Yeah.
And what are we going to do with, are we going to have a conference center? Right now, if you have any conventions come in, they're at the resort, which is on the reservation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
We don't have anything in Prescott. And I understand these guys are planning on a 250, 350 amount of people in their conference room, or is that right? Or am I off?
Well, they'll have some meeting facilities within the hotel building itself. And then, of course, they will have a connection to the railroad trestle that crosses the creek that's been there for many, many, many years.
And that'll all be upgraded.
And it'll be all be upgraded. Right now, it's blocked off because it's no longer safe to even walk on.
Right.
So that'll be allowed. And then they're negotiating with Prescott College to acquire the Sam Hill Warehouse and then repurpose that as a meeting space.
So we have some questions here.
Right.
First of all, Dan Cox wants to know, how come we had to pay some guy to come in and ask the people who live here what we need, and why didn't the mayor and Prescott City Council just do that on their own and save the money? And then we also...
Is that the Ron Drake question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Corey Gardner wants to know, he said, am I right that Sam Hill will be torn down to be replaced by a new Hilton? And also, Phil, you've been asked to speak a little louder.
Okay. I'll get a little closer to the microphone then.
Speaking louder for the room so that the
gotcha.
Can hear you. So there we go.
Well, let me answer that second question first. No, the Sam Hill warehouse is not planned to be torn down. It is not on the Hilton Hotel property. It's across the creek from it. Mm-hmm. It's currently owned by Prescott College. And the plan is to acquire that for the operators of the hotel to acquire it from Prescott College and then to use the interior space as a meeting, large kind of meeting location, possibly even maybe a small convention. Right now, it's primarily being used for artist studios and gallery displays. So they want to keep the exterior and the structure as it is and just repurpose the interior.
It used to be a great nightclub. I remember I used to go there with my wife and we'd go dance, and it was awesome.
Mm-hmm. And then the other question was the Ron Drake. Keep in mind that the his consulting fees were primarily paid for by the Chamber of Commerce and the Prescott Downtown Partnership. The city was sponsoring a small portion of that, not a significant amount, and his reputation as someone who really can help identify some key areas of improving or upgrading or enhancing downtowns is pretty substantial. So I think he's a legitimate consultant in that area. But I participated in the last visioning evening where we had about 100 people in the room, and I think about 12 or 13 different groups that brainstormed on the things that they would like to see enhancing the downtown core. And quite frankly, many of the things that were suggested are things that the city is already working on. We already have plans for. Some of them have already started. Some of them we're planning to do. So I didn't really see any dramatically new ideas. Some of them are somewhat impractical. We can't have broad sidewalk dining on Whiskey Row. You know, are you going to tear down the buildings and move them back so you have a bigger sidewalk? That's not going to happen.
Don't start that rumor. Don't start that rumor.
No. But, you know, there is some already. I mean, you've got sidewalk dining in front of Lone Spur, in front of Terra Thai, Mob Burger. Quite a few of those places will have a table or two. So we could do more of that, perhaps. But, you know, I think his experience is working with declining downtowns. You know, we have a vibrant, exciting, wonderful downtown that can be, you know, kind of polished up a little bit, but I don't want to see it change too much. I think everybody who comes here falls in love with our courthouse and our downtown core, and there's a few things we can do, and here's one I'm working on. How do you like to see all those run-down, multicolored plastic news boxes that are on every corner, it seems like, in the Courthouse Plaza area? Half of them are empty.
Yeah.
And they don't really give you a nice, positive, clean look at our main area. Mm-hmm. Well, I've been working with the city manager over the last 6 or 8 months to come up with some bids on how to put a nicely designed pavilion type news box structure that I've seen in other cities where, you know, you just have the doors that'll come down, but it's clean and neat, and that way we don't violate any First Amendment rights for news, but we have a much cleaner looking, less kind of
those old boxes that
I mean, they look bad.
You throw 50 cents in, they don't open.
Those ones. So we're working on that, and that's going to come up pretty soon.
The Ron Drake, though, I got a feeling that you're right. He, to the listener that's watching us, he didn't want to change it. He's more of an enhanced guy, and he was talking a lot about the empty buildings that we have downtown. What can we do with them? And that's like the territorial courthouse. Mm-hmm. You know. Can you have retail on the bottom, condos living on the top? Dino Boleri's got a bunch of vacancies up there.
Right.
And I mean,
and the old Prescott Athletic Club was designed exactly for that. We've had a couple of people who it's changed ownership, but they want to do the same thing. Retail on the bottom, maybe some condominiums on the second and third floor, which is exactly what a lot of people seem to be interested in doing. In fact, I think we've got a third owner that's bringing forward a plan to the pre-application conference for the city that I attend weekly that's going to try to do the same thing. So,
Phil, how about a public restroom halfway down the first street of North Cortez? And you could put your newspaper things on the outside, but none of those places down there will let you go tinkle. And when you go into those antique stores, you spend hours in there, you gots to go. And when they say, oh, there's a restroom at the courthouse, that's a long walk.
Dan Cox wants to know if the Ron Drake event was a waste of money.
I don't think it was a waste of money, considering the high level of interest that a broad segment of the community wanted to participate in. He actually made the comment that in most cities that he's worked with, he's had a real difficult time trying to get 100 people in the community that wanted to even participate. We not only filled up that room, but we had a waiting list of probably another 100 people.
Right.
Mm. So there is a broad spectrum of the community that's very interested in this concept, and having kind of a guided way of identifying what the priorities are, mm-hmm. And not just have someone within the city government decide that these will be the priorities. And having that kind of public input, I think, is very valuable. Yeah. And considering the small amount that the city contributed to this, I think it was probably dollars well spent.
Good deal. All right. As you know, Phil, we're coming to the end of the show here, and there's one thing I always want to say thank you to, and that's your service to the country.
Yes.
You are a Vietnam veteran, a combat veteran, and
combat infantry veteran.
And we are so thankful for your service, and thank you for everything you've done for Prescott. You know, for a young guy, you really have done a lot of stuff for our community, both as a council person as well as volunteer, and you've always been there, and you've always been there for me too, being this is our first show. I called him up and I said, Phil, I need your help again. And you know, Phil knows I'm a retired guy. I'm pretty new behind the mic. I stumble a lot, but I knew being a friend of Phil's, I would be able to sit here and have a conversation with him, and that was our goal.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and knowing you and working with you has been very beneficial for the city, for the residents of the city. And of course, I listened to you and Chris on other radio programs.
Other radio shows.
It's always been very, very entertaining. So I had no qualms about joining you today.
Wow.
And I've served my country. And I hope that I can have a continued opportunity to serve the people of Prescott.
And you know what? This is serving the people of Prescott, mm-hmm. because I don't know if many of the viewers know, but a council person gets $500 a month to do the job. And that basically covers your banquets that you have to go to, the fundraiser things.
Yeah,
I mean, and Phil, how many hours a week do you find yourself putting in?
I kind of tracked it for the first few months of my council term, and I was putting in about 30 hours a week.
Yeah.
And I could do more.
And a lot is at night.
It
you
is.
Know, like where people want you to show up to their event.
Mm-hmm. I think I did 3 evening events this week alone.
And do you hug your wife and tell her thank you for letting you do this? Because
I actually took her to last night, so.
Yeah. I know, but my wife is so glad when I got off council, because every date we had, her dinner was like the cheese balls and the fruit trays. I mean, she didn't get too much. And, you know, the conversation revolved around how come I have septic and not sewer.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't really
some really cool stuff, huh?
Spouses are great. They got to support you going in that local
for sure. Yeah, she's great. She's really helped out a lot. And before I was elected to council, I was a member of, I counted 14 different organizations in the county and the city.
Yep.
So when I said, would you support me to run for council? She goes, yes, but you better start weaning yourself from some of those organizations. So I have done that kept my word.
Last few minutes, is there anything you want to bring up, talk about, or statements that you might want to make?
No, I just, sometimes people who keep track of my votes on the city council realize that I do take a contrary position when I don't necessarily agree with some of the expenditures and how taxpayer dollars are spent. But, you know, it's usually the 6-1 vote.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, some people are calling me Dr. No.
Dr. No.
And the fact that I look at every dollar spent.
Yeah.
And one of my fellow council members calls me Mr. Scrooge.
Mm-hmm.
Because
I saw
those
that.
Are taxpayer dollars.
Yes,
you know,
right.
And they better be justified. But I think a lot of the things I have been able to get done have been behind the scenes, working with the city manager and and getting things like maybe these post boxes. A lot of people maybe not notice that we now have these little lines at the end of the parking stalls on Gurley, with the signs up there. It says if it doesn't fit, don't park.
Yeah,
because you're going to get a ticket.
Yeah.
Well, you can thank me for that because some of these really extended bed trucks are so extended into the traffic lane that we've
hazard
turned Gurley into a one-lane road, or you get hazard trying to avoid those and drive around them. So, you know, if there's other places for those big trucks to park, and those might seem like a little thing, but sometimes they can really enhance our quality of life.
Yeah.
You know, I think when it comes to votes, too, a lot of times the public doesn't understand. Like, say there's a vote for, we like everybody to have a red shirt. And, you know, everyone says, that's a great idea, let's do it. But, you know that each red shirt is costing the taxpayers $5,000.
Right.
So you vote no, and then all of a sudden you're against red shirt people. You know, I mean, and that's extreme. Right. But there's a lot of things where you're voting no, not necessarily because of the obvious on the surface subject, but there's deeper things attached.
I don't consider those votes a popularity contest. Mm-hmm. I'm a conservative, okay? And what that means to me is I believe in limited government, low regulation, low taxes, strong public safety component. I believe in traditional family values. And those are things that I will fight for because I think they're the best way of government to work. And government should be limited, and I'd rather see each individual have the choice and the individual responsibility to make the decisions that are best for them and best for the community, and not have government come in and make those decisions for them. So when I vote against the $5 per person on a red shirt, it's because I say government shouldn't be in that business. People should be able to keep those $5 in their own pocket and decide if they want a red shirt or a blue shirt or a white shirt. It's up to them. Mm-hmm. Individual responsibility is what made this country great.
But you know, five other of your council people claim to be conservative Republicans too, so I'm kind of surprised that you don't have more support when talking about those things. Don't answer anything, just leave it there.
That's for another show. Kidding. Well,
we
know what's
a whole hour on that one.
We could sit here and keep on going and going and going, but I think we better wrap this thing up. Thank you so much, Chris, for coming in and helping me out and being the co-host and being my wingman. We were talking before the show. I'm not really good behind the mic yet. I'm still learning how to do this. And, when we do our other radio show, I always look to you and say, okay, now what do I say? So I'm so glad that you're here with me and helping me out. And
Glenn, you're a natural.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, you could tell by my introduction. Where am I again? No. But thanks again, Phil. Thank you so much for everything.
Pleasure.
It's kind of funny. You know, we talked about what we were going to talk about before the show, and we didn't talk about any of that. So, it's amazing how this thing goes, down the wormhole.
Right.
But anyway, thank you so much. And thank you, Prescott, for
found it interesting.
Yeah. Thank you for tuning in. Hopefully, we'll be out doing this bi-weekly. And this is Prescott Talks. I'm your host, Glenn Martin, co-host Chris Cupneo. Our special guest today was Phil Good. And we thank you so much for tuning in.